Nelson Rockefeller lived a life of spectacular contradictions. Born into America's most famous fortune in 1908, he spent his career trying to prove he was more than just his grandfather's billions. This was a man who could casually give away millions, yet chase down staffers over $10 expense discrepancies. Time magazine called him the most liberal Republican in America, yet he ordered the bloody retaking of Attica Prison that left 39 dead. He possessed boundless charm that connected instantly with voters, yet remained fundamentally unknowable even to his own children. His childhood unfolded in almost unimaginable privilege, in Manhattan's largest private home with a $500,000 playhouse complex, yet his parents instilled strict values, requiring meticulous accounting of modest allowances and creating what Nelson remembered as an ongoing seminar in public responsibility. Behind his confident smile and easy manner lay a complex man driven by both insecurity and ambition, whose life would shape American politics for decades. Nelson battled undiagnosed dyslexia throughout his childhood, reversing numbers and scrambling words, a condition he wouldn't learn about until his 50s. This created deep shame, particularly when struggling to read the 23rd Psalm during family vespers while carrying the Rockefeller name. This contradiction fostered both profound insecurity about his intellectual abilities and fierce determination to prove himself. Lincoln School's learning-by-doing approach provided a nurturing environment where Nelson's leadership emerged early. He created a fifth-grade constitution with a chairman's oath and committee appointments. At Dartmouth, he succeeded by building relationships with professors and studying intensely at Woodstock before exams. His academic improvement led to Phi Beta Kappa honors, partly motivated by his desire to convince his father to buy him a car. For Nelson Rockefeller, art provided both escape and expression, a realm of absolute freedom from family constraints. Alfred Barr Jr. noted, "Nelson needs art more than any man I know." For the dyslexic Nelson, art offered a wordless language that bypassed his linguistic challenges. His mother Abby's influence grew as she co-founded the Museum of Modern Art, which she told him would be ready for you when you get back to NY to live. Nelson's 1937 South American trip proved transformative, blending his mother's artistic interests, his father's philanthropy, and his grandfather's business acumen into a coherent identity. In Venezuela, he was shocked by the contrast between Standard Oil's compounds and local squalid living conditions. Unlike many officials, Rockefeller developed a genuine connection with the region. John Camp observed, "He was something of a Latino himself. He loved at his ranch to go out and ride horseback with local cowboys." When Hitler threatened Latin American economies, Nelson developed a U.S.-Latin American cooperation proposal. Roosevelt appointed him to chair what became the Office for Coordination of Commercial and Cultural Affairs between the Americas, dismissing concerns about Nelson's Standard Oil ties. "When he's in trouble, he's your boy. You get him out of it." Nelson launched his Washington career in August 1940 with $3.4 million from Roosevelt's emergency fund, expanding from 4 to 1,400 employees. His Rockefeller office countered Axis influence in Latin America through economic and cultural initiatives. After Pearl Harbor, his basic economy program aimed to raise living standards throughout Latin America, positioning democratic capitalism against anticipated Soviet influence. His notable early achievement was confronting American companies with Nazi connections, personally pressuring General Motors and others to replace Nazi sympathizers. Nelson established partnership Servicios through the Institute of Inter-American Affairs, providing U.S. technical assistance via local agencies with gradually declining American support. By war's end, his agents had trained over 10,000 workers, making him second only to Roosevelt in popularity among Latin Americans. When the United Nations formed in 1945, Rockefeller played a key role at both the Mexico City and San Francisco conferences, though his outspoken advocacy for Latin American interests eventually led to his dismissal from government service. After returning to private life and brief ventures in Latin America, Rockefeller ran for New York governor in 1957. His campaign was intensely personal, traveling 8,500 miles, shaking 100,000 hands, and delivering 135 speeches in just 10 weeks. Even his opponent's supporter Jackie Robinson admitted it was almost impossible not to like the man due to his focused attention on each person. As governor, Rockefeller approached major challenges with characteristic optimism. "We created these problems, and we can solve them if we put our minds to it." His greatest achievement was transforming higher education. When he took office, New York ranked 47th in public higher education support, with SUNY comprising just 29 underfunded institutions serving 39,000 students. By 1973, SUNY had become the world's largest university system, with 250,000 students across 64 campuses. SUNY Chancellor Clifton Wharton remarked, "Only Nelson Rockefeller could have pulled it off." His ambitious building program transformed New York's infrastructure, though critics called it his edifice complex. Through personal force and strategic use of public authorities, he reshaped the state with concrete and steel. When facing financial limitations, he created new funding mechanisms, believing that if something is worth doing, you find a way to pay for it. Despite his gubernatorial success, Rockefeller's presidential ambitions repeatedly faltered. His 1964 campaign against Barry Goldwater represented moderate Republicanism's last stand against the rising conservative tide. At the San Francisco Cow Palace, Goldwater's supporters drowned Rockefeller's anti-extremism speech with boos and catcalls. His 1968 presidential bid proved contradictory, late starting, poorly managed, and thematically scattered. Despite spending nearly $10 million on the first-ever pre-convention television ad blitz, the campaign revealed what money couldn't purchase: a candidate with sufficient passion and clear direction. The 1971 Attica prison riot became a pivotal moment in Rockefeller's career. Ignoring appeals from civil rights leaders and his corrections commissioner, he ordered state forces to storm the facility, resulting in 35 deaths. His initial description of the operation as beautiful and exclusive sympathy for hostage families severely damaged his standing among liberals. When Gerald Ford offered him the vice presidency in 1974, Rockefeller accepted despite family concerns about White House constraints. When questioned about taking a position misaligned with his hands-on style, Nelson admitted, "But Dick, this is the closest I'm ever going to get to the presidency." Tensions developed between Rockefeller and Ford's chief of staff, Donald Rumsfeld. Though Ford assigned Rockefeller various tasks, these proved largely ceremonial, with his policy initiatives facing resistance from an administration focused on limiting spending. After being dropped from the 1976 ticket, Rockefeller's influence waned. On January 26, 1979, he died at his New York townhouse. Henry Kissinger's eulogy captured Rockefeller's essence: ebullient yet withdrawn, gregarious and lonely, joyful and driven. The service concluded with Lionel Hampton's jazz band playing Sweet Georgia Brown, Rockefeller's chosen exit music. This final contradiction, a somber funeral ending with joyful jazz, encapsulates the man who lived between worlds: privilege and public service, ambition and insecurity, vision and pragmatism. Nelson Rockefeller reminds us that even those born with every advantage must still find their own path through life's contradictions.